Welcome to Extremely, a podcast from the ADL Center on Extremism. I'm Oren Siegel.
And I'm Jessica Reeves.
Today, we're going to talk about a range of topics that I think people are going to find very interesting, if not a little depressing. First of all, we're going to see how some folks used International Women's Day. Now, forget this. Celebrating terrorists.
Why not? We use everything else to celebrate terrorists. Why not?
There you go. We will then talk to our colleague about a recent example of how we held an extremist accountable through research and through our partnership with law enforcement. It's a good story. We need more good stories. Finally, we're going to dig into some data, and there is a lot of it, regarding white supremacist propaganda incidents around the country.
So, Oren, I'm just going to hop right into it. I'm sure you were very aware that March was Women's History Month.
I was. You reminded me.
I reminded you daily, and I know that you attended a lot of gala celebrations. March 8th specifically was International Women's Day. So in the midst of all of this, and you know, our general sense that we have achieved parity and feminism has won, et cetera, anti-Israel activists, I think you know where this is going.
Some anti-Israel activists, yeah.
Some anti-Israel activists took a more cynical approach to the celebration of women. And they kind of commandeered the annual event to celebrate actual terrorists. Now, These were female terrorists, so it fits the bill, I guess. But still, you know, these are full-on terrorists who have participated in hijacking and terrorist attacks. So I think this means that we did it and we can cancel International Women's Day next year.
I'm not exactly sure what is being celebrated there.
They talked about, you know, we can't forget about the role of Palestinian women in the battle for Palestinian liberation, but it just came back to praising some really awful people. And it was very weird and very tone deaf.
Yeah, so. I mean, we documented, you know, examples around the country of these demonstrations where folks were holding signs or images of Leila Khaled and folks saying, we stand with her. And people need to remember what she did.
Yeah, right. Hijacking airplanes. It's definitely, you know, it's a choice. One of our researchers wrote a really great piece about it, and we will link to it in the show notes. And I encourage everyone to go and read about it because it's just one of those things that you see kind of happening more and more in these progressive spaces. And it's super concerning. And, you know, as a dedicated celebrator of Women's History Month, I knew you would be interested.
It's just enough. The ideas that we are constantly seeing promoted, I think more and more blatantly, frankly, right? I mean, we did another piece recently that shows like terrorist symbols from the PFLP, Hamas, Hezbollah flags at these rallies. It's no longer just about supporting Palestinians. It's no longer about being critical of Israeli military action. All that is fair game. Like those are discussions that are happening in Israel every single day amongst Israelis and others. It's when you literally are constantly giving a drumbeat that is normalizing violence against people. And then going back in history to some of the most vile attacks against Israelis and celebrating those people who are responsible for that. I just don't know how that moves the narrative forward. I just think it isolates more people. And it's certainly not an effort to have dialogue with anybody. Frankly, I think it's on certain occasions more of an effort to intimidate.
And in all cases, it makes no one safer. As you said, it moves the dialogue not at all. It's counterproductive in every sense of the word.
Right. So some people may not know who some of these women that have been celebrated. I mean, again, without being sort of gratuitous, I do think it makes sense to remind people.
Okay. So for those of you who are not as familiar, and I realize this is a lot of people, because why would you be familiar with these women if you're not holding up signs about them, or even if you are holding up signs about them at protests? Leila Khaled is a longtime member of the PFLP, which is the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and is very well known for her role in the hijacking of not one, but two civilian airliners. So there was one in 1969 and one in 1970, and they both targeted either flights going to Israel from Israel or an El Al flight. PFLP is a designated terrorist organization here in the US, and they've been responsible for a ton of terrorist actions in Israel, including some that our other celebrant, Razmi Odeh, was also involved in. And Oren, do you want to tell people a little bit about Odeh?
Yeah, she was convicted, I believe, in 1970 for a bombing of a supermarket that killed some college students. Also connected to the PFLP. So, I mean, these are the folks that are being celebrated on International Women's Day by a specific segment of this anti-Israel movement that fails to see the irony of celebrating terrorists on that day. So now we're excited to talk about the good news, because we do have successes in this work all the time. We're not always able to talk about them. Today's different. We have our colleague, Morgan Moon. She's an investigative researcher who has some unique insight into some work she's done that led to what I think is just a lovely success story. It shows people there are consequences when you're terrible. So Morgan, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about how we were able to hold a white supremacist accountable for the terrible things he was doing?
We first became aware of this individual, I think in September of last year. And so we became aware of him, like many extremists, through an anonymous online alias. And he was operating online as NS hooligans or Nazi hooligans.
That was the usernames that he was using?
Yes, those were his like anonymous aliases that he was using. Obviously, he's not going to go by his first and last name. And so this was what he was going by online.
His aliases were definitely like little red lights. Like,
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, if you're using the name Nazi hooligan as your username, you might be like letting people know a little bit what you are about.
Or you might be a white supremacist, FYI.
Just maybe. Yeah, and so not only was he so obvious in his alias, but he also was celebrating and claiming responsibility for a variety of vandalism, white supremacist, and anti-Semitic vandalism incidents across the St. Louis metropolitan area. So, I mean, he was pretty obvious about it, saying, like, this was me, look who made the news, fellas, things like that. We also saw that this person was talking a lot about violent fantasies towards people of color, as well as Jewish individuals. He also was putting up white supremacist propaganda from a range of white supremacist groups. So like the White Lives Matter Network, the Active Club Network, the Women's Defense League. And so I think he's a really good case study of like an individual putting up three different types of white supremacist groups. This person was very active in the white supremacist landscape. And so obviously this person represented a lot of what we would call red flag indicators that would lead us to do a further investigation. This person was engaging in potential criminal activity. They were engaging in real world activity, so increasingly being active in the real world. And also, of course, there's violent fantasies or violent tendencies, in this case, towards people of color. So we launched an investigation.
And apparently you said claiming credit, kind of owning what was done. I mean, I almost wonder when somebody's doing that, do they want to get caught? I mean, based on what you saw, did this person think they were going to get away with admitting that they did this?
It wasn't that he was going to get away with it. I think his big thing was he wanted to build this reputation. He was so excited for people to, for example, repost his content. So like when a white supremacist group like the Western Chauvinist or these other like white supremacist influencers would repost his stuff, he'd be like so excited and talk about it. Like, look who just made it. Like, I got this many followers. Like, I think he really wanted to make a name for himself within the white supremacist landscape.
The Nazi hooligan name. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of times when he would do graffiti, he would also leave his tag. He would put like NS hooligan or NSH, which is like an abbreviation. Mm-hmm. So I think he just wanted to become this like prolific person.
Was he being celebrated? Was it like he would post this stuff and everyone would be like, yeah, you're the best?
You know, he had a lot of followers, but then also like the White Lives Matter Network, Western Chauvinist, and some other white supremacist groups would then like repost his stuff. Like whoever did this is a genius sort of stuff.
Right. It was a big win for him, obviously.
Yeah. And also like this individual, which we later find out was, you know, 20 years old. He's quite young. I think he just kind of saw this as his like start as becoming like some sort of white supremacist figure.
All right. So we keep interrupting you. So basically, you know, you're tracking this person who's claiming these terrible things that they're doing, is clearly promoting hatred, has these violent fantasies. So when we see that, which we, I think I could say, we see examples of this like every single day. What did you sort of do next in order to address this really concerning stuff that you're seeing, obviously?
At this point, as I mentioned, we kind of look for these like red flags, which there were a lot in this case. And so we launched an investigation. And what we do as investigative researchers is we kind of comb through the massive haystack of this person's online activity. And as is the case with many of these extremists that are prolific online, they're posting a lot. And so we're looking for those kind of needles in the haystack that allow us to either geolocate or identify the individual. In this case, the individual had made silly mistakes over time. And these kind of small mistakes allowed us to do an examination of both his Telegram, his YouTube, and eventually allowed us to make a high confidence identification that this individual was actually Frankie Rizzillo, who's a 20-year-old that's based out of St. Louis. And of course, when we make an ID, we then turn into a law enforcement alert, which we then sent out to various law enforcement agencies, alerting them to this individual that we were able to ID.
So we want to encourage white supremacists to keep making these mistakes, right?
In many cases, they're going to make them anyways. But yes, it is lovely when they make a small mistake.
So listen, I was going to comment on the same thing. There's so many things that we are looking for that we're obviously not going to talk about publicly. I guess my other question is, when you shared the information, you sense that there was something illegal going on, right? I mean, exactly. So like we share information with law enforcement about threats that we see all the time. What was it about this other than this person claiming acts of vandalism and the fantasies? I mean, was that why you felt that it was important to alert this to law enforcement?
Exactly. So we're not reporting every problematic person online to law enforcement because there's so many. What we look for, again, are those examples that this person might be engaging in criminal or some sort of violent activity. So this person seemed to be engaging in criminal activity in the shape of vandalism. He was putting, you know, this vandalism on the side of buildings, on the side of structures in the St. Louis area. This individual was also talking about targeting, you know, flags. So he would post like pictures of businesses that had flags outside, Target acquired, and he would go and steal these flags. In many cases, pro-diversity, an Israel flag in one case. In addition to that, again, those violent fantasies. So this individual was talking about how he was going to start carrying a knife around when he was going to put up this graffiti. And so seeing like all of these examples of potential criminality, that's why we're alerting law enforcement. So we saw this person as an actual threat to the community in which he was operating.
I appreciate that. And I want people who are listening to this to realize like in America, you can be as hateful as you want to be. And that's not necessarily a reason to share information with law enforcement. But we see a lot of people who we believe pose a threat to, you know, the safety and security of communities. And when they're claiming ownership of certain activity, when we feel like they are volatile and we're pretty good at assessing when somebody may be a threat to the community, we do share information with law enforcement. And so again, not to like narrate the story for you, but you share this information with law enforcement and then what happened?
We share with law enforcement and then our regional offices are in constant communication with their, you know, community partners in the area. So law enforcement, Department of Justice, as well as other community partners that might be involved in this. So we were in frequent communication, frequently answering questions. And then later, of course, what we find out is about 2 weeks ago on March 9th, this individual was eventually arrested. We found out that this individual was arrested on 2 felony charges related to property damages, both in discrimination, one on the basis of race, one on the basis of religion. He vandalized a church and a restaurant. And what we later found is the St. Louis attorney prosecutor thanked the ADL for our efforts and called our investigation essential to bringing charges against this defendant. So it's clear and amazing, awesome success story, you know, starting with investigation, leading to a law enforcement alert, and then, of course, seeing an arrest and actually bringing justice to this person that was, you know, threatening his local community.
You're essential. Your work was essential. And it's not just us saying that your work was essential. There was an outside validator that actually got somebody off the street saying it was essential. This is a great story. Thank you for what you do, Morgan.
We appreciate it, as does the greater community.
And for all those other Nazi hooligans online, there are people watching. All right. Anything else?
I think one thing to note is I think this is also a really good case study to show how one individual can have a huge outsized impact on their community. He was putting up graffiti. He was putting up propaganda from at least 3 white supremacist groups, and he was intimidating a large segment of the St. Louis area. And obviously, this individual does not reflect the values of the greater community. We welcome this arrest, and I think that this is a great case study of bringing justice against one person that was intimidating a large community.
We talk on this podcast, and people who see the work of the COE are obviously seeing a lot of analysis and information and data about really terrible things. Part of what we're trying to do here is like let people know how we do the work that we do, the people behind that work. These stories are really important, not only for obviously the community, right? Like hopefully they're a little safer because of this work now, but also because like for us doing this work, where are you finding your victories? How are you celebrating your wins? And, you know, periodically when we see that our work has a direct impact on the ability of keeping communities safe, like that's just a good day. So for all of you who are listening, this is an example of a good day.
Yes. And thank you, Morgan, for bringing it to us.
Indeed. All right. Thanks, Morgan.
Thank you.
COE released its annual assessment of white supremacist propaganda in late March. And this report, which comes from one of our most senior and most awesome researchers, has tracked incidents of white supremacist flyering, stickering, and banner drops nationwide since 2017. That's 7 years. I can't believe it's been this long. I'm always astonished by how much time we have spent doing this. Yes, how much time I've lived. Well, Orton, do you want to talk a little bit about some of the big findings?
Sure. 2nd year in a row, it was the highest number of white supremacist propaganda incidents that we have tracked, with over 7,560. Over that amount. The exact number is 7,567. So this is a 12% increase from the previous year. Also, among the propaganda that was distributed in the various different ways you mentioned, Jessica, there was a 30% increase in propaganda that was specifically anti-Semitic, targeting the Jewish community, which is not a surprise based on some of the other data and reporting and trends that we've been seeing about the rise of anti-Semitism, not just post October 7th, but with all sorts of other trends and activity like swatting and bomb threats that we've been tracking. So the increase was largely due to white supremacist group Patriot Front, that reincorporated anti-Semitic narratives into their propaganda. They had sort of always been anti-Semitic. They stepped away in terms of the major sort of ideas that they were promoting in that propaganda, and now are sort of back to doing that. And again, like we've talked about how hatred of Jews crosses any ideological or political boundary, but the anti-Zionist and anti-Israel elements can also be found in a lot of the propaganda that we saw after the October 7th massacre. So they were applauding Hamas, violence against Israelis, which we were sort of recorded an uptick of outside of propaganda as well. More sort of on that in a later podcast.
And we're also seeing, which is really, really significant, we saw 141% increase in incidents targeting the LGBTQ plus community. And that's obviously like a huge underpinning issue that we're seeing as well. And frequently there's a convergence between those two things, anti-Semitism and anti-LGBTQ plus vitriol, especially among white supremacists. We see this happening and it's distressing for communities. It's super alarming to wake up and find white supremacist propaganda on your lawn or driving to work and it's on the overpass.
Just a cheap and easy way to harass people, make them feel like intimidated. And the states that had the most activity, according to this report, Texas.
They should be most stressed out. Yes.
Was that Virginia? Yeah. Virginia, Texas, California, New York, Massachusetts, Missouri, Tennessee, Michigan, Maryland, and North Carolina. 48 states.
On that list. Congratulations.
Yeah. You're the big winners. But seriously, like, I mean, there's a lot of activity in those states, 48 states and the District of Columbia. We recorded and documented this type of activity. The two states that we did not, probably not that surprising, Hawaii and Alaska. Now, I don't know if that means they're the safest place.
I mean,
it's far, right. It's far. It's too far to record. No, I don't think they're the safest places, but I think that it requires further investigation. And I will be traveling to Alaska and Hawaii to personally investigate.
Maybe you want to take Alaska and I'll take Hawaii and then we can report back.
Yeah, we flip a coin, something. So, you know, the other thing that we are releasing in addition to this data, which, by the way, people can find on our heat map, again, by city, town, where it's coming up, what groups are responsible for it, et cetera.
And we released a really cool sort of assessment of regional issues. So if you have information about white supremacist propaganda in your area, you can always report it to your local ADL.
Yes, absolutely. Right. I mean, we rely on not only our own tracking of this activity, but reports from the community that we might otherwise not know about. So really, really important to report. We also are providing a toolkit this year, though, that enables people to kind of understand what options they have if they find themselves targeted by this type of propaganda. And so we often hear from communities, this was just left on my front lawn. It's pretty scary. Like we tend to have a light tone here, but when somebody finds like white supremacist propaganda on their lawn or in front of their home or in front of their institution, you got to think like who around me is doing that. And so sometimes it's somebody coming from out of state. Sometimes it may be local. We don't always know, but this toolkit provides you with a list of opportunities of what you should be doing, reporting it, not just to ADL, to law enforcement, how to document it, et cetera. We'll include that toolkit in the show notes as well.
I'm smiling only because it's very easy right now for me to imagine you standing on your lawn, like shaking your fist at the white supremacists and yelling, get off my lawn.
Yeah. I mean, and having a lawn in New York City, right? Really kind of a difficult thing. I think that's what makes the image funny.
Among many other things. So we have that. And we are really proud of the reporting that we've done. We'll link to it in the show notes. Again, annual report, massive increases. So we can say with some confidence that white supremacists are very good at using photocopiers. They've achieved that success in life.
So this annual assessment, it's just one data set, but it's an important one that we come out with every single year. One way of quantifying the activity and the hate that we're seeing in communities, especially that activity that is specifically targeting the Jewish community, the LGBTQ community, African-American community, immigrant community, literally on a daily basis. We're talking about over 7,000 incidents. So as flippers, we sort of are about this. And as numbers kind of eventually have no meaning, the larger that they get, each one of those is actually a person or a family or a community that had to sort of try to make sense out of what they're seeing.
Yep. It's really hard to overstate the emotional impact of something like that. It's just, it's an incredibly disturbing experience. So
a deep breath, a sigh, good punctuation.
Yes. So Oren, as we always do, we're going to talk about our life rafts, what is keeping us afloat this month. It is spring where I am, which means both huge amounts of snow and crocuses. I'm very excited about the crocuses, less so about the snow, but you know, we need the moisture. It's all good. I'm also weirdly happy about the time change this year. Like normally it makes me mad because I'm like, why are we losing an hour on Sunday? Like, why does it have to be on the weekend?
But you're getting more light.
Well, except in the morning, then it's super dark in the morning. The point is that I love having it be light, like, you know, at 7:00 PM. It makes me so happy. Maybe we could just take the hour away from like a work day on a Monday as opposed to a weekend sleeping time.
Right. How about we just don't mess with the clock ever?
Another option. Yes. And there's a magical land called Arizona where that happens.
Well, I don't know. Is that an argument to... Yeah. No offense to Arizona.
We've seen what's happened in Arizona.
And all our listeners in Arizona, please don't send us nasty emails.
But do send us key lime pies.
So is it my turn for a life raft? I'll be honest with you, I struggle with this.
That's kind of why I press you on it.
Yeah. I mean, even from some of the topics that we discussed today, like these are not pleasant topics, right? They suck. We see the impact of bad people have on good people. But like, we get to do this work. And like today's success story that you heard. And I know people feel like people in this space must be constantly distraught. Like I hear that a lot. How are you doing? And I really appreciate the outreach, especially these days as more and more people who either support our work or are interested in our work or who elevate our work are asking us, how are you guys doing? How do you find that sort of balance between work and life? And, you know, there's such heavy stuff. How are you all taking care of yourselves? I hear that more. I love that question. For me, the life raft is doing the work. I know that sounds weird. I'll have a better answer next time. It'll be key lime pie again, of course. But like doing this work is the life raft. Yeah. Because if I had to like do something else and read and know about all these things and see how my community and other communities and friends and family are impacted by this, and then like, no offense, go back and be an accountant somewhere, that sucks. I feel privileged to be able to do the work of like focusing on this stuff. That's my honest answer. It's not a commercial. It's the truth. It may sound like nothing, Jessica, but it can be everything.
Thanks so much for joining us this month. As always, we are grateful for your listenership. We're happy that you're here in whatever medium you are choosing. Join us next month for another episode. And in the meantime, please reach out to us. We love getting your emails. We love getting questions. And please send them to us. The email address is extremely@adl.org. We do monitor that mailbox, so please send away. Any question is welcome. Nothing is too big or too small. I'll see you next month, Oren.
Maybe.